From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today we conclude our series featuring some of our staff's favorite interviews of the past decade. We'll hear my interview with Jordan Peele, recorded in 2017, after he wrote and directed the horror film Get Out, which he described as a social thriller.
Part of being black in this country is constantly being told that we're seeing racism where there just isn't racism, that we're not seeing what we think we're seeing. It's a perfect state for a protagonist of a thriller.
Also today, our 2016 interview with Francis Ford Coppola about making his masterpiece, The Godfather. We spoke after the notebook he made in preparation for the film was published.
It's not personal, Sonny. It's strictly business.
That's on Fresh Air Weekend. First, the news. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. We're concluding our series of some favorite interviews from the decade that just ended. I interviewed Jordan Peele in 2017 after he wrote and directed the film Get Out. The film was nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture. Peele won the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. Peele was also nominated as Best Director, and he became the first African-American writer-director whose debut film earned more than $100 million at the box office. Get Out is a horror film with racial anxiety at its center. It's about a young African-American photographer, Chris, played by Daniel Kaluuya, who's dating a white woman, Rose, played by Allison Williams. After they've been together for a few months, Rose decides it's time for Chris to meet her parents, but she says she hasn't told her parents that Chris is black. Don't worry, she reassures him, they're not racist. In fact, she says her father would have voted for Obama for a third term. Chris is not reassured. When they arrive at Rose's parents' house, the parents, played by Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener, go out of their way to be friendly and to show how much they appreciate black culture. But there's something suspicious beneath their genial, liberal surface. Let's start with a scene from early in the film. Chris and Rose are on the way to her parents' home in an affluent suburb. She's driving when the car hits a deer. They pull over, a police officer arrives, and asks Chris for his ID.
Sir, can I see your license, please?
Wait, why?
Yeah, I have state ID.
No, he wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving, I asked to see his ID.
Yeah, why? That doesn't make any sense.
Here.
You don't have to give him your ID because you haven't done anything wrong.
Maybe, it's okay, come on. Anytime there is an incident, we have every right to ask.
Asshole.
Ma'am,
everything all right, Ryan?
Yeah, I'm good. Get that headlight fixed. And that mirror.
Thank you, officer.
Jordan Peele, welcome to Fresh Air. I should mention we can't see Chris, the boyfriend, the African-American boyfriend, cringing and trying to, like, disappear during that scene. What are some of the things the Allison Williams character did wrong?
Well, you know, part of this scene is about the white girlfriend who's dating her first black boyfriend getting woke to a certain racial dynamic for the first time. So, you know, part of this story is watching her wrestle with the racial implications of all these interactions that she's never really had to wrestle with before. For Chris, or for, you know, African Americans in this sort of situation or other situations that arise later, the experience and the perception of the racial undertones is an everyday experience. Right here we see Rose sort of coming into her own wokeness for the first time, and whether or not she's onto something with the cop is up to the viewer in a way.
So you call your new movie a social thriller. Is that your coinage, social thriller?
It is. It is.
I like it. Why did you need a new term? Why did you need that term?
Well, you know, people who watch this film tend to, you know, have a hard time describing what genre it is as well. And I sort of knew that. It's not, you know, we sort of market it as a horror. And I'm a huge horror fan. And I think you could put together a really good argument that it's a horror, but you could also put together an argument that it's not, that it's closer to a psychological thriller or something. But because it's not about the psychology to me as much as it is about society, I call it a social thriller. It's in the same vein to me as like The Stepford Wives.
So how did you come up with the idea of a social thriller focused around a young African-American man who's taken by his white girlfriend to meet her parents, and things don't go as planned for anyone?
Yeah, the gestation period for this idea was, you know, kind of spanned several years. And I think one of the most important milestones in that process was just realizing that, you know, every true horror, human horror, American horror, has a horror movie that deals with it and allows us to face that fear. And except race, in a modern sense, hadn't been touched. You know, it really hadn't been touched, in my opinion, since Night of the Living Dead 50 years ago. Maybe with the film Candyman. And that, to me, I just saw a void there. So it really started with this notion of, like, this has to be possible. Let's figure it out.
So why the idea of the white girlfriend with the black boyfriend bringing him to her parents?
At some point, I realized that the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was really the perfect starting point for this film. I think one of the reasons that film was, it resonated so powerfully, is that it's a universal situation. Take race out of it, we can all relate to the fears of meeting our potential in-laws for the first time and the feelings like we might not be what is expected. So I just thought it was a great entry point to help make this movie inclusive, to help make it something that you don't have to be African-American to emotionally connect to the main character here.
And the parents, when they meet the Allison Williams character's boyfriend, are trying to be like so cool with the fact that he's black. They're masking any discomfort they might feel by being like overly jokey and overly friendly, and you can really sense this discomfort. But they're very like liberal and open-minded, or at least they think they are. And so I want to play a scene, and it's a little hard to make out what they're saying because there's a lot of jokey asides here, but you'll get the kind of tone of it. So
yeah.
Allison Williams has just brought her boyfriend home, played by Daniel Kaluuya, and the parents, played by Catherine Keener and Bradley Whitford, are, you know, again, trying to be like super friendly and cool. And Bradley Whitford, the father character, speaks first, and what he's asking here is like, so how long have you been together? So here we go.
So how long has this been going on, this thing? How long?
4 months.
4 months?
Mm. 5 months, actually.
She's right. I'm wrong.
Attaboy. Better get used to saying that.
Please, I'm so sorry.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. She's right. I'm wrong. See?
Does he have an off button? This is exhausting.
I know, and I want to give you a tour.
Can we, like, unpack first?
You want to unpack before the tour?
So you obviously wanted to put in things that white people sometimes say to black people to make them think like they're really aware of and in sync with African-American culture.
Yeah, you know, a part of being black in this country and you know, I presume being any minority is constantly being told that we're being too aware of race somehow. We're obsessed with it, or we're seeing racism where there just isn't racism. So it was important to me to, first of all, put the entire audience on the same page of what it feels like to be aware of these little subtle interactions and the sort of underlying racism that is sort of like just being even slightly distracted or to be made aware of your own race in a normal conversation. So, yeah, I sort of teach the audience early on that, you know, Chris, played by Daniel Kaluuya, is he's nervous about meeting these parents and he's nervous that she hasn't told them that he's black. From that point forward, any little, whatever you want to call it, microaggression, you know, sort of lame reaching out to make a connection, it becomes aware to the audience, and we get the giggles of awareness from audiences.
So again, you've made a kind of horror film that plays on real racial fears and stereotypes and discomforts. And the movie starts with a young African-American man on the way to visit his girlfriend in her suburb. And he's totally geographically lost. The streets all look the same. Her address is on, I think, like Edgewood Street, but Edgewood Street is right near Edgewood Lane. And he's wondering, like, who does that? Who puts Edgewood Street close to Edgewood Lane? How can you possibly know where you are? And he's a little nervous, especially when a car passes him by and seems to be slowing down and watching him. And you know that this character is thinking about Trayvon Martin. And you know most people in the audience are probably thinking about Trayvon Martin. But you don't have to mention Trayvon Martin's name in this. And you don't.
Right. This scene, for me, is the entry point into allowing a non-black audience to relate to real fears that we experience. I think after this scene, for the rest of the movie, everyone knows that there is a threat of racial violence just around the corner. And that is the state that black people have when they feel like they're might be perceived as the outsider in the wrong neighborhood. So it's very important to me to just get the entire audience in touch in some way with the fears inherent of being black in this country as a starting point.
So have you ever been in the position of being the black boyfriend brought home to the white girlfriend's parents and the parents didn't know that you were black until you walked through the door?
You know, it's hard to know. I was dating a white girl many years ago and went to meet her parents. And I do remember asking, do they know that I'm black? And she said no. And that fear, you know, was present. It's like, oh, gosh, you know, the worst case scenario, of course, is really bad. But even if it's just a small adjustment that I have to witness on the parents' face, it'll just be such a bummer. It'll be such a buzzkill, you know. It would be just something I dreaded. And that to me, when I met the parents, it turned out to be fine. I don't know if she told them or if they were just cool, but that's, you know, the reality of how it turned out is actually less important to me than the fact that my fear was coming from somewhere very real.
So in horror films, usually like the main character has seen something nefarious or is being hunted by a monster or alien, but no one believes them. And the main character starts to question his or her own sanity. And that kind of happens in your movie Get Out, but it has all these racial overtones to it. And I think it's interesting that you're using this form, this genre, to get at that feeling of uncertainty, of not knowing what someone has just said or done actually has a racist overtone, or maybe you're overreacting, maybe you're projecting something that isn't fair, you know, because this, that constant uncertainty until we really know what the story is.
That's right. One of the...
Do you experience that a lot, that uncertainty? Like, I don't know if that person said is kind of racist, or am I just like projecting that on? I mean, I've experienced that as a woman a lot. Like, that thing that guy just said, is that really sexist, or does he understand what he just said? You know?
That's exactly right. I think we're wired at this point to look for these interactions and to wonder and to sometimes, you know, to call them like we see them. But we're also, you know, I think any minority, women, gay people, you know, we're constantly told we're not seeing what we are seeing. You know, I'm glad you brought up gender, because this thing you're talking about is also present in The Stepford Wives.
You know, I've never seen that. Should I see that?
Oh, you should. If you like Get Out, you should absolutely see it. It's one of the most well-crafted social thrillers that there is. And in it, much like in Rosemary's Baby with Mia Farrow, the protagonist is in this state you're talking about, where it's crazy enough that something awful might be going on, but it's also real enough that something just normal and awful might be going on. And so what ends up happening is we see that state that you've described as being part of being a woman, I describe it as being part of being African-American, is being told we're not seeing what we think we're seeing. It's a perfect state for a protagonist of a thriller, because it helps keep the character in this unfolding dire situation longer, because he, she can sort of mentally justify why this might be, you know, something that they're overreacting or going crazy about.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another thing. I wanted to make a movie that satisfies an audience's need for a character to be smart.
You've said that you knew by the time you were 13 that you wanted to make a horror film. How did you know that?
I was a very scared child. Not so much of life, but of the demons that lurked in the dark, and horror movies terrified me. You know, I'd love watching them, but then at night I would just be up in sweats all night. At some point, I swear, Terry, it was like my mind just shifted in order to cope with these fears. And, you know, I sort of became obsessed with this idea of mastering my own fear, that if I could do what these, you know, great horror people did, that I would be wielding this power as opposed to being a victim to it. That's what happened. I fell in love with horror films.
What's one of the films that really scared you when you were young?
You know, one of them that really got me was Nightmare on Elm Street. There was something about the way that, you know, Freddy operated with so much malice, and also the way that those movies, you know, the sequels especially, begins almost being told with Freddy as the main character. It was almost as if we were meant to identify with this monster more than the teens he was killing. And he had this weird dark sense of humor. Something about that really disturbed me to my core.
Were you afraid of his hands that have these, like, you know, knife-like fingers that you can slash people with?
Terry, you are so cute. Yes, I was scared of the knife glove. Yes.
All right.
I was terrified of the knife glove. I was terrified of the idea that you can't escape him by going to sleep. But, you know, really what got me was this sort of urge that, you know, the movie was trying to make you relate. You know, people would cheer, you know, Freddy's little, you know, he'd kill somebody brutally and then say, like, you know, some stupid pun, you know, like, game over, chump, you know, he's like kills a guy with a video game or something. And then, like, the audience, like, laughs and is on, and I was not, you know, on Freddy's side. I was, like, terrified of Freddy. So that was this interesting period in horror where the audience was sort of invited to relate to the monster. Kind of started with this stalker vision idea from the 70s where, you know, the camera would be lurking behind the trees watching, you know, some sorority girl taking a shower. And, you know, that whole world of things is terrifying to me, because they're asking you to identify with your internal predator or something. It's very, very disturbing.
So one of the things that you draw on this is this fear of somebody kind of like invading your brain, like not only getting under your skin, but like invading your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a theme of a lot of horror films, like Invaders from Mars. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, it's a great one. I think it's from like the 1950s. Like aliens land and transplant these things into people's heads, and they mm-hmm. look like the same person, except they look hypnotized and they're not behaving the same because they're under the control of these invaders from Mars. But the main character in your movie, the guy, he's a smoker, and his girlfriend's mother offers to hypnotize him and help him stop smoking, because that's one of the things she does in her therapy practice. And his friend urges him, don't, she might get into your mind. This figures into the story in a larger way that I won't describe. But I really, watching the film, I was really wondering, like, are you a smoker? Did you try hypnosis?
I used to smoke. I have not tried hypnosis, but it is something that, you know, I think is kind of universally scary to people, right? This idea that, oh my God, what, when somebody can probe into my psyche, there's no telling how vulnerable I'll be and what kind of influence they could have. Mm. You know, albeit this is a stereotype, but it's grounded in reality. Black people have not had the experience with therapy as a whole that white people have, or at least there is a heightened fear in the black community of this idea of going to a psychiatrist. It's like, no, I'm good. I'm going to go to church, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another reason why I thought this sort of mental probing, this whole thing, you know, Chris would sit down in this chair with Missy, played by Catherine Keener. You know, I could just hear the, you know, the black people in the audience going, no, 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 don't do it. Come on, get out of that room right now. Get out, get out, get out. You can sort of hear and sort of feel that. And, you know, Chris himself is appropriately skeptical of the process as well.
So this is like seems to me like a turning point in your career. It's established you as a writer and director and taken you kind of away from your other identity as a comic writer and performer. I mean, there are some comic aspects in this movie, but anybody coming in and just like expecting it to be a comedy is going to be surprised, because it's not that. But why did you decide to step away from what you were best known for, which is comedy?
You know, I think I've always felt that I would actually be better at this than I was at comedy. It's just one of these things that comes from a deeper place in my soul, and probably just comes from this fact that in order to deal with my own fears, I wanted to be able to sort of master them. So it's really just what I want to be doing. And I love comedy. I've been in love with comedy as well from a very early age. And it's comedy to me is a different way of doing the same thing. It's also meant to face our fears and to be able to laugh them off in a way. But this thing is just simply my truest passion.
Jordan Peele, thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Jordan Peele, recorded in 2017. We're going to conclude our series of some favorite interviews of the past decade with Francis Ford Coppola. We spoke in 2016, after the publication of the notebook he kept when he was making his masterpiece, The Godfather. He told some terrific stories about how he cast and directed the film. The notebook contains his thoughts about each scene, including the pitfalls he wanted to avoid. The notebook also includes pages from the novel that the movie is based on, Mario Puzo's novel, The Godfather. Coppola's notes are in the margins. The movie starts with these words.
I believe in America. America has made my fortune.
That's the character Bonacera, who has come to the Godfather, Don Vito Corleone, to ask a favor. Bonacera's daughter was brutally beaten after she resisted two boys who had tried to take advantage of her. Bonacera says he went to the police like a good American. The boys were tried in court, but the judge gave them a suspended sentence, and they went free that very day. Now Bonacera wants revenge against those boys. The Godfather, played by Marlon Brando, offers this response.
We've known each other many years, but this is the first time you ever came to me for counsel or for help. I can't remember the last time that you invited me to your house for a cup of coffee. Even though my wife is godmother to your only child. But let's be frank, you never wanted my friendship. And You were afraid to be in my debt.
I didn't want to get into trouble.
I understand. You found paradise in America. You had a good trade, made a good living. Police protected you, and there were courts of law. But you didn't need a friend like me. But now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, give me justice. But you don't ask with respect. You don't offer friendship. You don't even think to call me godfather. Instead, you come into my house on the day my daughter's to be married and you ask me to do murder for money.
I ask you for justice.
That is not justice. Your daughter is still alive.
Let her suffer then. As she suffers. How much shall I pay you?
Buonasera. Buonasera. What have I ever done to make you treat me so disrespectfully? If you'd come to me in friendship, then the scum that ruined your daughter would be suffering this very day. And if by chance an honest man like yourself should make enemies, then he would become my enemies. And then they would fear you.
Be my friend? Godfather.
Good. Someday, and that day may never come, I'll call upon you to do a service for me. But until that day, accept this justice as a gift on my daughter's wedding day.
Grazie. Grazie.
Francis Ford Coppola, welcome to Fresh Air. It's such an interesting way to start the movie because we're starting the movie by looking at a man, tight close-up of his face. We don't yet know who he is. He's speaking. Then it pulls back, and then we see he's speaking to Brando, and then we hear Brando speak, you know, Don Corleone. So why did you make that the opening of the movie?
Well, actually, I was working on the screenplay in a little cottage, one-room cottage in Mill Valley, and I had begun the sequence with the wedding itself, you know, the looser shots of the people coming, the guests in the 40s and what have you. And I had maybe 15 pages when a friend of mine, a screenwriter named Bill Cannon, his name was, I remember, and he came and he visited me. And I said, well, you want to see the first 15 pages? And he looked at them. He says, you know, Francis, you did such a good opening on Patton. That was such a striking opening for the Patton movie. Couldn't you do something more like that, something more unusual that kind of got you into it? And I thought, well, there was, you know, some truth to that. So after he left, I had the idea to begin in this way with this very, very close shot of the supplicant undertaker, Buonasera. And then slowly reveal out of the darkness of the Don's studio, as opposed to the brightly lit wedding scene, the various characters, you know, the Brando himself, his son, Sonny, and what have you. And I rewrote the opening and added it to the screenplay.
Are there ideas and images, stories from your own family that you put in that opening wedding scene?
Oh, absolutely. I knew nothing about five crime families, which had recently become exposed to the public with the publication of the Valachi papers. But neither did Mario Puzo, who was also Italian-American, but he knew nothing about it. And he wanted to write this book sort of to get some money for his family. He thought it could be commercial, and he did everything on research. He knew nothing. He never had met any of these figures, and he advised me never to meet them, which I never did.
What about after the movie? Did you meet any of them then?
Mario Puzo was just a wonderful man, and I always took his advice to heart. And once when I was working on Godfather Part 3, which in my mind was the Death of Michael Corleone title, I was in this video truck, which had only one door. And there was a knock on the door, and a fellow who was, you know, sort of helping me and guarding me, as it were, came and he says, John Gotti is here and would like to come pay his respects. And, you know, I remember Mario Puzo saying, never, never know them, never meet them, never be a friend of theirs because they're very charming. And I said, well, tell them I can't possibly do it. I'm busy in the middle of something. And the fellow went out and told him, and he just went away. You know, I always thought of these figures of the crime family sort of like the old myth of vampires, which a vampire can only come into your life if you invite him to step over your threshold. But if you don't invite him, then they won't.
I'm sure people who were in the mob would be very flattered to hear that comparison to vampires.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, they are Italians and Americans, but they were not human beings that acted beyond being like animals, in my opinion.
Did you worry, though, that the film was setting the wrong example because the characters became such heroes of popular culture and there were Italian-Americans who felt that, like, you were discrediting Italian-Americans?
Well, you know, in truth, I was worried about so many things during the making of that movie. You know, I was like about 29 when I started. I had two kids and one about to be born. I had absolutely no money. I was making what had become a more important film than it was when I got the opportunity because the book had continued to become more and more important. And I had no power, and yet I had real opinions on how it should be done, and I was always just trying to bluff the studio to let me, you know, do it my way, and it was just the most frightening and depressing experience I think I've ever had.
I'm sorry to hear it. Thank you so much for making the movie in spite of that. So you write that when you actually you were invited to direct the movie by the studio, by Paramount,
right?
And you sat down and read the book. And you write, I read it eagerly, but barely finished it. And you almost didn't make the movie because you didn't really like the book, in spite of the nice things you said about Mario Puzo. What didn't you like about the book?
Well, I had thought from its title and the intriguing logo and the name Mario Puzo that this was a kind of Italian intellectual writer, like a kind of, Moravia or something, and it was going to be a piece about the subject of power. And while indeed it was about power, I found the book itself more like a kind of bestseller attempt, like an Irving Wallace book. People don't remember it, but maybe a third, if not more, of the book concerned this young woman, Lucy Mancini, and her private anatomy problems and a love affair with the doctor who fixed them. And I just couldn't believe how low class that was. But that was, you know, not included in the movie, and so it didn't harm the remaining part, which we all know.
Did you ever tell Mario Puzo your thoughts about the novel?
Sure, he knew, and you know, he had written a beautiful book called The Fortunate Pilgrim, which he felt was the best book he ever wrote, which also was about immigrants, but it was very respected by writers, and it was a beautiful book, but it didn't make money, and you know, like so many Italian Americans, he adored his children, he wanted to give his children some, you know, better life, and he wrote this hoping it could make a lot of money for himself.
It did.
And it did.
So you write to yourself in the Godfather notebook, with the Godfather, there is always the possibility of immediate and sudden violence. That's certainly true. You had to decide how explicitly violent to make it. What was your conversation with yourself about how the violence should be handled?
Well, I confess that I was very impressed with Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde.
I thought about that when watching Sonny Corleone get shot.
Without a doubt, and I thought that the effects, the depiction of violence in Bonnie and Clyde always had an imaginative twist to it, that it's one thing to see someone shoot someone, but if there's a detail, the way the blood turns into mist, and I saw that in Bonnie and Clyde, I thought was just absolutely wonderfully done, and I looked up who had done the special effects, and that wonderful man, A.D. Flowers, his name was, worked on The Godfather and on Apocalypse Now, and he was just the most, you know, in the film industry, you deal with a lot of people on the crew who are sort of geniuses in the rough, you know, the way they come up with ideas for special effects and what have you, and I've been blessed to have those people help me in making these films. The films are a tremendous collaboration, as you know. It's not a one-man show by any means.
Okay, well, perhaps the most, or at least one of the most memorable scenes implying violence in The Godfather is the horse's head scene. It's the scene.
That's a good example because it's not done in the movie the way it's done in the book.
Yes. Okay. So let's. Why don't you set up what happens? Like what happens in that scene?
Well, it's a famous movie producer who is proud of his stable of beautiful stallions and priceless. A horse could cost $500,000 or more in the 40s. And they've asked him to cooperate with their request to give the singer the role. And what happens famously is that the producer wakes up and he sees a shadow. I'll describe it the way it is in the book. He sees a shadow and he opens his eyes and he looks and he sees the severed head of his beloved and prized stallion that has been decapitated. Well, when I had to direct that, I thought, well, gee, you know, maybe it would be interesting if at first the man, you know, to trick them, to make it think something else, that maybe he had been mortally wounded, that he wakes up and he feels something weird and he uncovers the sheet and there's some blood and maybe his leg has been shot off or he's been castrated or, you know, let the audience think something else has happened. And then as he panics and flings the bloody sheets away, it then reveals the severed head of the horse.
In your notebook, you keep a list of pitfalls, of things that you're afraid to fall into.
That I should avoid.
That you should avoid. So your pitfall to not fall into for this scene, you write, if the audience does not jump out of their seat on this one, you have failed. Too much in the Corman horror film tradition would be a mistake. And you had worked for Corman early on in your career.
Indeed.
Right. One must find the perfect balance of horror without losing the thread of the overall film. Deliver it and get out. So you wanted a kind of horror element, but not to make it kind of like a cheap horror film?
Yeah, and also everyone knew, they had read the book. That was one of the famous scenes of the book. So how could I mislead them to think that maybe what they thought was going to happen mm-hmm. wasn't going to happen for a second? And that's why I put the horse's head in the sheets so that he could think the blood was his own blood at first.
So casting Marlon Brando was just such a really brilliant stroke and stroke of luck as you were able to get him. And I want to play what Mario Puzo told me in 1996 when I interviewed him about casting Brando, about how Brando got cast in the movie. So can I play that for you?
And then, of course.
Okay. So this is Mario Puzo, who wrote the novel The Godfather, speaking with me in 1996 about casting Marlon Brando.
I'm the guy that picked Brando.
You did pick Brando.
Oh, sure. I wrote him a letter, and he called me up, and we had a chat, and then I tried to get Paramount to take him, and they refused. And then when the director came on the picture, I talked to the director, Francis Copeland. He managed to talk Paramount into letting Brando play the role. But it was my idea to cast Brando, which caused me a lot of trouble before it finally got done.
What did you say in your letter to Marlon Brando when you were inviting him to play the part?
I think it was something like, help, they're going to kill me. They're going to cast, I think it was Danny Thomas as the guy.
Danny Thomas? Wow.
Yeah. Well, he was going to buy Paramount so he could play the role. At that time, Paramount wasn't really worth that much. And Danny Thomas was very rich off television. And I read an item, he was going to buy Paramount Pictures so he could play The Godfather. So that scared me so much, I wrote a letter to Brando. I knew some people who knew him, so, you know, I had an entree. And he gave me very good advice. He said, no studio will hire me. Wait until you get a director, and then talk to the director. And he's quite right. When I talked to the studio, they swore they would never hire Brando.
Okay, Francis Ford Coppola, you were the director. I suppose Puzo talked to you, and you made it happen. Can you pick up the story from there?
Well, it's true that Mario had always liked the idea of Brando, but, you know, Mario was often Bayshore. He was not really on the scene so much, as even a lot of my work with him was my sending him drafts and him writing notes. So although he had posed the idea of The Godfather being Brando, I don't even know if he told me that. Because I just was hit by a whole bunch of ideas from the studio. Danny Thomas was one, Ernest Borgnine. It was a whole bunch of ideas. Even Carlo Ponti was suggested. And finally, I came down to the thing about the character of that character was that, you know, you couldn't find anyone new as we had done for all the other parts. Al Pacino was totally unknown. Johnny Cassell was... Bobby Duvall was relatively young, so a lot of new people got big parts. But like a man who was supposed to be in his 60s, it couldn't be new and like had never been in anything before because what was he doing all those years? So finally with my colleague in casting, Fred Roos, we said, well, who are the two greatest actors in the world? So we said, well, Laurence Olivier and Marlon Brando. Each one had a difficulty for that part. Olivier was British. He was perfect age. He looked like one of the real guys, Genovese. And Brando was only 47 years old. He was extremely handsome, as always. He had long, flowing blonde hair. And most important, he had just been in some pictures, notably one by the great Pontecorvo called Burn. That was a huge flop, tremendous financial flop. So the studio felt that Brando was supposedly difficult to work with, sort of irresponsible, you know, would cause big delays. The film was only budgeted for $2.5 million, you have to understand. It wasn't like we could throw money around. And my decision to make it in the 40s and have period cars and shoot in New York was already impacting the cost, so that's one of the reasons why I was so unpopular. But they also hated my casting ideas. They hated Al Pacino for the role of Michael, and they hated Marlon Brando for the role of the Godfather. And I was told categorically by the president of Paramount, says Francis, as the president of Paramount Pictures, I tell you here and now, Marlon Brando will never appear in this motion picture, and I forbid you to bring it up again.
But you won. How did you win?
Well, when he said, I forbid you to bring it up again, I like feigned that I just fell on the floor on the carpet and like, you know, as if, you know what? And then I said, what am I supposed to do? If you tell me I can't even discuss it, how can I be a director? If the part I think should be cast, that you won't even let me talk about it. And I said, all right, we'll tell you it this way. One, if he will do the movie for free. Two, if he will put up, if he'll do a screen test. And three, if he'll put up a $1 million bond that he will in no way have any misbehavior that causes the overrun of the picture budget, then you can do it. So I said, I accept. You know, so at least they were saying if I did three things, have a screen test, if I could get him to do the movie for nothing, and if I could have him put up $1 million, which is absurd. But at least I said I accept, meaning, okay, now I can talk about it.
So did he do the movie for free?
No. I called him up and I said to Marlon, you know, of course this is an Italian-American, you know, wouldn't it be fun if we could, like, do a little experiment and kind of improv and see what playing an Italian might be like? That was my way to talk to an actor, essentially asking for a screen test, but I didn't put it in those ways. And I knew that if I could do something with this little screen test that was convincing, the absurd idea of him doing it for nothing, although they didn't pay him much more than nothing, I think they paid him scale, which was an insult, and obviously the putting up a bond to prevent misbehavior was, you know. Sometimes, you know, you say you accept terms, meaning that you just have a way to continue. So the important thing was to do some sort of a little screen test that I could get on tape and show to all these executives.
So you played this kind of little trick, and he did improv on, or whatever, on film for you. What did he bring to that audition that he didn't realize was an audition?
Well, I had always heard the rumor that Marlon Brando didn't like loud noises and he always wore things in his ears. So I took a couple of my colleagues from San Francisco from this period of, you know, having young filmmakers all have a come. And I told them all to dress in black and no one was to speak. We would do sign language. And so we descended on Marlon's house early in the morning. He wasn't up, and these dinges went to different corners and set up their cameras. And I also brought a whole bunch of, like, Italian sausage and little Italian cigars and provolone and little things, and I put them in dishes around just without even saying what I was doing. And then the door opened. They said he was going to wake up, and the door opened. Out came this beautiful man in a Japanese robe with flowing blonde hair. And we're shooting all of this. And he came out, and he didn't talk very much. Marlon was a brilliant man, and he just knew what was going on instantly. And I remember he came and he took his hair and he rolled it up and made it sort of like a bun in the back. And then he took shoe polish and he made it, and he was mumbling the whole time. And he made the shoe polish and made his hair black. And then he put on the shirt that I had brought. And I remember him folding the lapel. He says, "Those guys always, their lapel is always folded," he said. And right in front of my eyes, then he said, "Oh, he's shot in the throat in the story. Somebody should talk like this, you know, his throat." And he started doing that. And right in front of my eyes, he transformed himself into this character. And I couldn't believe it. And then he started picking up the sausage and eating it. And he just gravitated to the props and was using it to create a kind of Italianness the way he did it. And the whole time he was just going like this. He was going, he wasn't saying anything, which was funny because his phone rang. This was his home. This phone rang and he picked up the phone and went, I said, "My God, who was it who called? What are they going to think?" But when it was all done, I had this tape and it was quite remarkable.
People were afraid in the studio that Brando would be hard to work with and he would create problems. Mm-hmm. Did any of
Absolutely.
That happen?
Yeah, not at all. He was a joy to work. You don't talk a lot to Marlon. You sort of just give him, like I would take a cat and put it in his hands, or I would have some Italian props. Or you don't direct him by talking about acting. What he likes to hear is make it more angry, make it less angry, make it sweeter. You know, he doesn't want to have any acting kind of talk, but he knows obviously what he's doing.
Was it Brando's idea to stuff his cheeks so that he'd look really jowly?
Yes, he said he wanted to look like a bulldog.
Francis Ford Coppola, thank you so much for talking with us about The Godfather. Thank you so much for making The Godfather and for insisting on the things that you wanted to make it as good as it is.
No, thank you so much and for your wonderful program, which I've enjoyed throughout many years.
Francis Ford Coppola, recorded in 2016.